Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is May 26th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. We are all over the place today. I am homesick. You can hear it in my voice and in my tenor. Danielle Riendo is in Lobby 1, keeping Lobby 1 locked down.
I'm alive in Lobby 1. That's definitely a thing.
And Rob Zachney coming to us from L.A., Los Angeles, the city of angels.
I'm in my kitchen, and everything is covered in flour.
Oh, good.
Are you cooking?
Are you making stuff?
I finally broke down and got one of those like meal prep subscription services.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Not Blue Apron. Mm-hmm. Peach Dish.
Okay.
Which had slightly better reviews. And last night I finally like forced myself to actually like cook food rather than go to Grubhub and have like one of three health disaster meals brought to me. and I feel really good about that. It's been a good decision, and it feels like I probably should have done this months ago rather than continue to try and prep like full size meals for me living by myself.
Just you,
in LA.
Yeah. We do that. I have a. Actually, my girlfriend and I double up, so we have it is Blue Apron, but we have a meal every night, and it's pretty. Nice. It's actually pretty good. I think it fits with this particular lifestyle. Yeah.
Wait, which particular life? Like the New Yorker, journo,
like
barely
New Yorker,
at home.
You work quite a bit. You're not at home very much, but you still want to cook. You still want to eat healthfully. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to cook. This is completely her idea, but I reap the benefits, and I also do the dishes. So you know,
it works out. That does sound like it works out. I haven't been cooking. I haven't been doing anything. I don't have any subscriptions. All I got is a new piece up on waypoint.vice.com about Far Cry 5, which is a game I sort of saw a little over a week ago.
You've been cooking up takes.
I've been cooking up these takes. That's actually like not as – I had to turn this take around way faster than I wanted to because I think it's a really complex thing, and the time I had to write this week was way lower than the time I needed to spend like booking E3 and making sure the budget was right and all that other
stuff. I'm glad you talked yourself down from like embedding yourself in the American heartland for like 3 weeks.
I really wanted
to just really get it.
Move to Montana and, you know, see who I could talk to. You know,
shoot
see
at
if
least
I could
five
get,
deer.
I
want to
work
the
land.
Shoot at least five deer. I'd probably miss, but that'd be okay. That'd be like some verite. You know what I mean? A little bit true storytelling. So I saw Far Cry 5. I saw a presentation that Ubisoft gave at a hotel about Far Cry 5 back at Judges Week. And I've been like dying to talk about it because it left a real impression. And I like the long and short is I think that they're setting a really high bar and I hope that they clear it. But I am pretty excited to see them try, which is not a thing I've said about a Far Cry game since. Like, I didn't even say that about 2. I just happened to like 2 a lot, but I kind of went into it very skeptical. But then I really went, 3 was not a good look for as far as I'm concerned, and 4 was surprisingly good, but I did not have high expectations for it. So
yeah.
I guess the quick and easy brief on it is Far Cry 5 takes place in modern-day Montana. There had been some rumors that it would be a Wild West game. It is not. It takes place in modern-day Montana in a fictional county called Hope County, where a group of an end-of-days cult called the Project at Eden's Gate, which is a really good cult name because it's the sort of name that a real cult has. It's not just like, do you know what I mean? Like cult names for real are really bad. Like they're like clumsy. And I like the Project at Eden's
Gate.
They're
way too involved.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Also, there's an NPC in one of the trailers who calls them Peggies, which feels weird because like a PEGI. Do you know what I mean? Like Peggy, but also
Peggy,
that's what,
18.
Exactly, right. Peggy, yeah. 18. If you've ever watched like a European trailer, at the top of it, instead of having like an ESRB rating, it has a Peggy rating, and there's a guy who says Peggy 18 or whatever, and yeah. It's really weird that they're called Peggy's. Anyway, Project Eden's Gate is a cult that is also a militia. There are lots of vibes of the kind of sovereign nation movement. There's a lot of vibes of like, or sorry, the sovereign citizen movement. Lots of like right wing prepper culture, and the kind of pitch that they gave us was. The creative director on the project, the executive producer, Dan Hay, said he wanted to make this game back during the kind of year after the recession, 2008, 2009, 2010, in that era. But that there was kind of a pushback from inside that was like, this isn't realistic. The West is one big global village. Like, things are not going to become unstable enough for a militia to take up arms on American soil. And then in the last, like, 4 years or so, kind of, like, with the rise of, you know, I think knowing how timelines work with games, it really probably means, like, the rise of the Tea Party, the rise of things like the standoff at Bundy Ranch, a number of encounters with sovereign citizen movements over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. But then, you know, kind of egged on in the last three years by the rise of the alt-right, by Brexit, by Trump, obviously, like... It all lines up to say, like, actually, this is totally a much more believable fantasy military conflict thing. And so you play a rookie, like, cop, basically. You play a rookie deputy in the county who's going in to arrest, or I guess he's going in to investigate. I don't know. He's going in to right? Also, not even he, because you choose your character's gender and also their skin color. You're going in your job for the first time, and things go bad, and then the kind of like Cold War, or kind of the press release uses the phrase the quiet coup that the Peggies have been doing over the last few years, or maybe even longer than that, in Hope County, kind of explodes and becomes much more violent. And it's a really complex thing. I left really struck by that presentation.
Yeah, I want to ask you, please, Austin, what do you want from the finished game?
Like, I don't know.
What is your fantasy version of this
so
game?
So what I'll say is, like, the thing that's weird about it is, so there's been some response to this, especially after the key art was released, which is like their cover art, basically, which has for the last few games been the big bad guy on the cover posing, and in this one it is the big bad guy who is like a priest, kind of like a well-to-do priest with sunglasses, surrounded by his, like, his followers and, like, his lieutenants, basically, who are also dressed in various, like, mixes of religious garb and, like, rural garb, right? Like, plaid.
Flannel and plaid.
Yeah. That's, like, with arms cut off and jeans. And I think some people saw that and were like, great, like, we've gone from killing brown people to killing poor people. But the thing that I most want the game to do is to avoid that by, and this is kind of what I wrote about, by really emphasizing that these sorts of cults and militias prey on the people of these places who are the working class folk who live in rural Montana, who, you know, the same way that any group of extremists prey on the weakest people there. And I don't want that to be – the thing that's going to be tough is I don't want that to be a point of spectacle, right? Like, I think Far Cry 3 and 4 have both had moments where it's like, look at how bad the villain is. Like, oh, there's, you know, incidences of, you know, sexual harassment or assault. Like, oh, you walk down the road and you see a widow, you know, running away from assholes. Like, I don't just want that. Like, that's not how these elements in society actually function. Like, they actually function by getting their hands in all of the local, you know, elements of government, or they become really powerful through land deals, you know, like the sort of stuff that I love about noir storytelling in a weird way is like, oh, it's bureaucracy, it's connections, it's relationships that are leveraged. And so the big thing I want is for, like, the people of Hope County to be there to feel like they are real people who want to live their lives, and for this cult to be kind of not just corrupting them in this kind of like Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom, like evil religion way, but in a much more like – There's a word I'm looking for, and I'm losing, and I'm too tired to find it. A much subtler way, you know?
Like, this is ruining our culture, our space.
Our space, right? Yeah. But at the same time, like, it's going to be a tough thing to do that in a way that doesn't feel shitty. Like, I think it's a high bar for them.
Well, and it's a really high bar for a Far Cry game to hit. Because I think the problem you run into is, I think the game that you're sort of describing, the way that world would sort of feel like, would be, I'm going to cite two shows that I tend to really like. There's a show called Longmire, and there's a show called Justified.
Yeah.
And both of those, over time, they begin as like tough guy cop procedurals, and Longmire has its issues. But over time, they increasingly just become about a community.
Right.
And the divisions within that community and how it's evolving and changing amidst like hard times. And eventually those places sort of start to feel very real, and they start to feel lived in. And you begin not only to get a sense for the way things used to be, how different people live now, but you also get a sense for how these outside forces are creating new pressures and schisms within these already hard-pressed communities. But to do that, you actually need a storytelling backdrop that isn't all conflict all the time.
Right.
It needs to be a place where you can explore and live.
Exactly. There needs to be this like low rumble of conflict, not open gunfights, right?
Right. And Far Cry lives and dies on dudes in 4x4s whipping around with like Kalashnikovs and just going at each other outside cell phone towers.
And that's what's going to be here a lot. You know, like, they showed us a gameplay, like, not like a first-person trailer. I guess there was actually lots of first-person, like, actual combat in it. Like a kind of a gameplay montage. They didn't show us, like, a single, like, sequence. And that montage was, like, you know, picking up your buddy in your car to go out and get into gunfights with the people from the militia, and, you know, having a dog friend who can disarm an AK-47 from someone who's shooting it at you, which is really cool. I like the dog. It was a good dog. And, like, yes, that is what this game is, and it's what these games have always been structured around. I think that there are ways to address that can, to some limited degree at least, transform it. Like, I'm not someone who thinks... There was a conversation that I was in the other day on Twitter that was basically like all open world games have this colonialist bent because the open world is built for the player to explore and own, right? And I think that is a valid line of argument, but I also think that there is a range of execution that you can see a huge difference between, say, Far Cry 2, which is a world which you can't take over anything. You never make any space safe or yours. There's no marking on the map that says, this is my tower now or this is my zone. Versus Far Cry 3, in which you literally paint the map your color, right? Like, you literally are killing people in outposts so that they're yours and that your people go in there now. And so what I want to see is a variation further on this, especially coming off of a couple of Ubisoft games that are, like... So, weirdly, I think the thing that this has made me realize is, like, the Tom Clancy side of Ubisoft has just given up on even pretending to be socially conscious. And like, fuck it, man, go kill brown people in Bolivia.
Bolivia, right.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the streets of New York, right? Go kill these looters, quote unquote. Versus the Ubisoft side of Ubisoft, right? The non-Tom Clancy, the Ubiverse, which is like Far Cry and Watch Dogs 2 and Assassin's Creed to some extent, has gotten more and more interested in trying to like address those problems inside of their own stories. And they haven't always been perfect, but I think Watch Dogs 2 takes a step forward, even though it also fucks up in some big ways. I think Far Cry 4 also took a step forward. And so I would say, and even, you know, think about Assassin's Creed, things like Freedom's Cry and Liberation.
Syndicate was actually also not...
Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. That are like at least attempting to address those issues, right? So my hope is that they find some variation in the same way that in Watch Dogs 2 they moved away from like the towers system to create a kind of looming sense of dread in certain spaces that are not violent spaces but are not like purely coded as safe zones either. Do you know what I mean? Like, so the trailers that they released included lots of like, oh, it's a bait shop. Oh, it's like Main Street, like USA, and it's the bar. And I would love those spaces to be places like I go to get ammo refills and get better body armor and also sometimes a fist fight breaks out, right?
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, you capture a tower and then the tower goes back to, or at the tower, you capture an outpost, but then like the outpost is brought back into the fold of the church, right? They could probably do stuff that's really interesting with your NPC companions around like, hey, who are you showing attention to, right? Like, who are you maintaining your relationship with so that they don't get brought into this cult? I don't know what they're going to do around that stuff, but I think there's opportunity to play with that stuff and to have it be more than just backdrop. And if it is just backdrop, then I think that's a missed opportunity. For the record, I also think that that's true for the kind of character creations. The first time a Far Cry game has had character creation, you can be a man or a woman, and you can choose your skin tone. And if that's just wallpaper, then I think that they've missed the heart of what America's militia movement is.
Yeah.
Maybe not the heart, but a big component, right?
So in doing something like that, I saw you tweeting with Mitch Dyer, who's I think he's a developer at EA these days. He used to be a game journalist, about something about, like, he said, I'm paraphrasing, but oh my God, I can imagine writing, you know, slurs, like 50 right. pages of slurs for that sort of thing, which is a fair point and a lot of work, certainly, and also a toll on anyone who's not
a piece of
shit.
Totally.
But absolutely worth it to actually have this fiction mean anything.
Well, what happened? Yeah, so that was a fun little exchange because, like, I like Mitch a lot and totally understand that. And I could see why it would be a toll on a games writer like Mitch to write that stuff. And then someone else followed up. Someone else I didn't know was like, and can you imagine being the voice actor who would have to read and reread those things?
Sure.
And like, all I could think was like, yeah, dog, imagine living in the world in which you hear those things.
Exactly.
Like, that is the world we live in that I've... And to be clear, I've written about Mafia 3, which during a preview event did that in a way that I thought they bumbled, but in the final game, they really landed. So I want to encourage people to figure that stuff out. And I hope that it's not just, you know, I hope that it's not just like a situation where the cult says like, oh, well, we're an evil cult. Like, don't get me wrong. We're the end times, but racism has got to go. And like, that's a really cheesy way to get around that dilemma of having to realize that inside of these power structures, things like race and gender completely still play the roles that they do in the world. You know, what do you want from a Far Cry 5 at this point? Danielle and Rob.
Go ahead, Rob. I've got ideas, but I want to hear yours.
Well, my problem is I might actually just want a first-person Jagged Alliance game in some way.
Oh, sure.
I think my problem with this series is that Far Cry 2 really only works, I think, because, one, it is so evocative of different, like, landscapes and climates. Like, it is such a gorgeous game. There are so many images and moments you're going to have in that world that just make otherwise dull tasks feel somehow amazing and epic, right? Like, you know, cresting a ridge in the desert and having the morning sun hit you for the first time and the landscape sort of catches fire. That stuff is like transcendent. And then, of course, it's really good gunplay. The combat is really good. And I think, for me, Far Cry has increasingly gotten away from that stuff. It's gotten a little more technicolor cartoony in some ways.
Yes.
And it's also gotten more conventionally Ubisoft open world, where a lot of these systems are intentionally made really limited or somehow gated or less than satisfying at the start so that you grind your way through the game and then the real fun begins. Then a bunch of new verbs open up. And that's kind of frustrating because ultimately what you're opening up is stuff that you can do in just about any other shooter from the word go. So, what I'm looking for really at a base level is just maybe get more back to that satisfying Far Cry 2 combat model and you know that sense of place and that command of imagery.
Yeah.
But then the thing that's really on my wish list, the thing I want, is the sense that this is a... I want to go into a place where you get a sense of how divided and foreign mm-hmm. the familiar can feel. That there are certain like no-go zones because, well, it's just sort of accepted that the weirdo cultists, you know, kind of control things up that road, and you don't go down that road unless you've got a reason. And the local police are maybe on your side, but maybe they're a little complicit. It's hard to read.
Right.
What are federal agents doing in this reality? How do normal working people feel about all this? And that's not stuff that's going to be brought out in combat.
Well, and so for me, that's part of why I was excited to see the three character trailers that they debuted. So there's like kind of three NPCs who are part of the, and I swear they're calling it this, the Resistance, which is the group of kind of vigilantes that you run or are part of eventually that kind of goes to push back the kind of cult slash militia that's taking over. And each of them is just like, oh, I'm a regular person, right? Like there's the bartender, her family has run this bar in town for years, and they, her mother and her brother were quote unquote taken by the cult and militia. It's not clear if that means like killed or brought into the fold or kidnapped or what. And when their father tried to go intercede, was killed, right? There's a dude who was a white dude who like is a crop duster whose parents or whose father and grandfather flew planes in America's various wars, and now, you know, by God, he, you know, he's gonna do it too. He's gonna fly his crop duster with a Gatling gun on it because he wants his children to grow up in a world without this cult in it or whatever. It's very pulpy. And then there's this black preacher, Father Jerome, who it like does the most like just again the pulpiest, most campy like reading of you know the Lord will be your shepherd and etc. And now if someone puts the flock in danger, I'll be the wolf type of thing.
Yeah.
And then like reveals inside of the Bible a pistol and then like walks out of the church carrying a shotgun in one hand and a, like a bulletproof vest in the other. But then like there's this other note which is just like the church has been bombed out, and in the longer trailer like you see them coming for his church. Like two guys with a gun. And there's this sense that like, okay, those are the vehicles for the thing you're talking about, Rob, which is how does the community respond to this low thrumming terror? And there will at least be a voice for that. I think that voice will be goofy in some senses. That's what Far Cry is. They are caricatures. They are sketches. They are like, you know, at best they're very memorable, and at worst they're like memorable for the worst reasons.
Right.
And but I think that's probably the angle that we'll see that stuff through, you know. No, I don't know. What if there was a police force in the game that showed up when conflicts broke out and you didn't know what side they would be on?
I mean, that sounds like what I would love from this game in terms of. It sounds like the best parts of what we've seen so far of this game evoke at least some of the best parts of Mafia 3, which were, you know, being pulpy but also genuinely having a stand and you know, wanting to say something. Whether or not it you know, completely was successful in that, maybe it wasn't, but it definitely had a point of view and a point of existence and wanted to say something instead of just being like, here's the thing, now go play.
Having that hedging.
Purpose. Yeah, yeah,
right.
Right. That's what I want. I just want a purpose. Even if it's pulpy, even if it's wacky, even if it's, you know, a little over the top, which is fine. I actually really enjoyed Far Cry 4. I didn't finish it, but I put a good 20-something hours into it and thought, like, this is not perfect by any means, but this is actually a very fun playground that at least is course correcting from some of the complete crap from the third game. So I am hopeful that they will continue on that ladder. We will see, I suppose.
Totally, yeah. I'm curious to see how it shakes out. It's not out until February, which is killing me a little bit.
Just a quick question. Anything there about sort of First Nations Indian characters?
Nothing in what's come up yet. And again, that would be a real drop ball for them if they didn't include something there. But also, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, it's going to be one set of side quests. You're going to know one Native American character. You know what I mean? Like it ends up being. Yeah. That's complete speculation on my part, right? Like, but that's how that sort of thing has been handled in the past by AAA games, and I want them to do better, you know? Yes. That's all I ever want from people and games is, come on.
Let's do better.
It's just that easy.
It's just that easy. So, yeah, so just to be clear, I didn't get any hands-on time with it. I just saw kind of a talk that was, like, again, a really intense talk about fear and about, like, the research that went into the game and feelings of instability. And if you want to read my explanation of that stuff, I just don't want to just repeat it all here, you can go to waypointadvice.com and read the article that I wrote about it, which is called Far Cry 5 is About Living Under Fear in America. So check that out. What have you two been up to besides listening to me tell you for the last week that I have all these thoughts about Far Cry?
I played some Rhyme, which is... A game Mike actually wrote about. Mike Diver wrote about this today, that it's very pretty, and it's basically like a very pretty puzzle game, very much in the vein of an Eco or Shadow of the Colossus, more Eco or The Last Guardian,
right.
Kind of evoking those, you know, very, very pretty Abzu, maybe Journey, you know, kind of those kinds of games, but more puzzly. And it's a very, very beautiful game. It has that gorgeous, very sort of cel-shaded look to it, a lot of pastels. What you do is you're pretty much a little character. It's kind of cool. You're a little, like, non-binary kid, which is nice. You have a little fox friend. And you can shout at things, which is just cute. You can hum. And you can also basically solve environmental puzzles. I dig it thus far, but I definitely also see what Mike was saying. Mike was a bit disappointed in the game, I think, saying like, oh, yeah, you know, there's certainly some good here. There's some good puzzles. There's some, you know, interesting interactions, but it all feels a little lightweight. And I definitely could see that. I've only played 90 minutes or so of the game, so I'm not through with it. I think it's probably about a 5 or 6 hour game. But yeah, I'm definitely enjoying it for what it is, but it might just be that it's a good chill out game for me right now.
Right.
And sometimes it's kind of what you want, what you feel like, what you need.
I watched you play Rhyme for a little while. You were playing it. Here's a little behind the scenes. You were playing it while we were recording our Binary Domain podcast.
I was.
Afterwards, I kind of hung out with you and played a little bit of it. And then the puzzle design was like pretty okay, but it kind of wavered between being a little too like handholdy, a little too like obvious, and being a little inscrutable. And that's a weird bouncing back and forth. Like it's one thing if a whole game is one way or the other. I can kind of get into that mode, right? Like I've played really straightforward puzzle games, and I've played things like I mentioned Gorgoa on the Post PAX podcast recently, where it was like, oh boy, this thing is hard to get my head around.
The Witness, as much as I insulted, I liked a lot of the very difficult puzzles there. Yeah,
totally. Whereas from watching you play this, it was like, this puzzle, I guess this makes sense. Like, I don't think it. And then the next one would be like, oh yeah, obviously just do XYZ. And that bouncing back and forth can be really tough.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else?
I'm playing Overwatch again, actually. Oh. In not in light of the anniversary, it's just, I finished Prey that one night after my 48 hours, and before jumping in again for the next Prey, Prey through. Sorry, that was terrible. But before that, I was like, "Hey, I'm gonna watch somebody stream something. And I'm gonna play some Overwatch." And yeah, it's still pretty awesome. I tried some of the newer characters. I hadn't played in almost a year, to be honest. Like I played a whole bunch when it first came out,
right?
And
me
then
either.
Just didn't touch it for a long time.
Yeah, last time I played was when. God, what is even her name? What is this?
Sombra?
No, before Sombra.
The robot lady?
No, before...
Anna?
Anna was the last time I played when Anna got added. So I've missed, all the PvE modes that they added for various, you know, small events. I've missed Orisa and Sombra. And I just, keep saying, I'll get back in soon. And then just, it's so hard for me to put it on the list above something else that we would be talking about in any given week, you know?
And the bar's
very much
higher.
I bet.
And that's the thing. It's like, I'm afraid, Rob. I'm so scared. What if I go back and it's just not fun?
I'm jumping back in. It is very fun, but it is definitely my podcast game. It is definitely the game I will put on for a little while and just play in the arcade mode or whatever, you know, the no consequences mode, whatever you want to call it, and just play a few rounds and have a great time as Zarya, the only character that makes any sense. Although I've had some success with Sombra, you know, new to me, new character to me. Playing as her is pretty fun too, but mostly Zarya. Zarya just makes sense to me, man. I don't know. We just have a connection there. I don't have to care.
Weird,
but,
huh?
You know, it's weird. It's weird. I like the buff lady. She's fun.
God.
But that's it.
Cool. How about you, Rob? What are you up to?
So the journey through Endless Space 2 continues.
Oh.
Ooh.
And I am continuing to really dig that game. And it's weirdness. So I finished the game I was playing as the United Empire.
Okay, which is like vaguely human, like
human
Starship
corporate
Troopers.
Fascist.
Okay.
Yeah. Very, very inclusive, though. By the end, I had a multi, like many, many species were part of our project, in part because I was forcibly incorporating other species into the United Empire, which, by the way, was a little weird. So there are elections in this game, and the elections are, again, surprisingly progressive. They use a ranked choice voting system in the in-game elections. So you'll have surprising outcomes where the initial polling will come back, and like the faction you might want is to sort of be running things.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is in second place. But when election day happens, they actually jump to the front because a bunch of the smaller factions listed that other faction as their second choice, and since they didn't like make it past the post, basically, the vote transferred. So it's a weird dynamic.
Wow.
Yeah, you look at the polls, and it's not actually like okay, the number one and two people are going to win. It's actually a little more nuanced than that. It really depends on where those third, fourth, and fifth choice people are going to send their votes after their. After there's a sort of, you know, instantly runoff.
Right.
That's so
a neat system that's, I'm glad they didn't just default to like an American system, because it turns out there's a ton of ways to do democracy. And unfortunately, I feel like we often just see that system in so many games.
Well, and it's very easy to comprehend, right?
Right,
like,
totally.
If polling results are translated instantly into who are your top finishers, that's easy to wrap your head around. But it's more interesting and more representative and, you know, I don't know, arguably a better way to run your democracy.
Right.
So the weird thing that happened, though, is toward the end of the game, as I was playing as the United Empire, I thought I'd been doing pretty well.
Okay.
And I had a really powerful industrial base, and I was making a lot of money equaling dust here, which is sort of the magical currency slash spice of Endless Space 2. And so I thought I was doing really, really well. It turns out, though, like, so Endless Space 2 is a game where you can kind of be good at everything, but the game really wants you to be extraordinarily great at something. And there are ways you can get there, but you really need to sort of... the way I'm increasingly looking at it is Endless Space 2 is very much a game that wants you to move from like one myopic focus to the next.
Okay.
And if you don't do that, if you don't go all in on a strategy and sort of sprint on that strategy...
Okay, so you don't mean going in a single playthrough from one strategy to the next. You mean like basically like, okay, this is my military playthrough. I'm going to be the biggest military power there is.
It's a little more like, okay, now I need to do some military stuff.
Okay.
And then you're going all in on, like, you're not just doing a little. It's not like you're building like a few spaceships and you're calling it. It's like, well, if you're going to build a few spaceships, you should build 50. And then you should go mess someone up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of what this game sort of seems to be asking you to do, because there's a lot of these like competitive quests where you'll achieve certain milestones that indicate that you aren't just doing this one aspect of the game. You're not just an industrial powerhouse. You're the biggest industrial powerhouse, and that's where you need to be. So I was running a pretty balanced like trade and industry empire until I realized that one of my allies were basically just like printing money over there, and they were going to win the economic victory. Like, they were going to have made to give you a sense, I was making about 3,000 dust a turn by the middle of the game.
That's a lot of dust.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? That's the sort of number you'd think.
Is it not?
3,000 things of dust, like kilos.
Yep, 3,000 grams.
Bushels.
3,000.
You know?
Yeah. Cubits, I believe, is
there are little Ziploc baggies full of dust, like everywhere. Basically, like we were loading them onto pigeons' backs. So 3,000 sounds like a lot, and it is. Like I had enough money that I didn't really need to worry about it, and I could afford whatever kind of army I wanted. But the economic victory is that you need to have made like 895,000 dust for the entire game.
Wait, so that are there just is that what the win conditions are? Or is it like as simple as that? Like, oh, I have 895,000 dust. Are you buying a thing at the end?
No, it's just that simple. It's like congratulations, your GDP now represents twice the value of the entire galaxy. Like, that's kind of where it goes. I don't know if it's inflation-sensitive, by the way. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is it is not, because otherwise it would sort of be the Zeno's paradox of win conditions, but I do need to look at that a little bit. Inflation is in this game, by the way, so have fun with that. Anyway, so I thought I'd been doing really, really well, and then it turns out one of my allies I get the notification, they're actually closing in on that victory condition, which also let me know, like, I'm making 3,000 dust a turn, and I'm not even in the ballpark. Like, right. I'm not even...
Wow.
So that
and there was no
sense,
way
like,
for them to give you a heads up that you needed to speed up? Do you know what I mean? There wasn't a...
I got a heads up. This wasn't like 5 turns to go, they're closing in on it. Like,
okay.
I got the first warning that this was in play, probably 50 or 60 turns, maybe more, before the end came. But the problem was there was another empire between me and my erstwhile ally. And so I'm still buddies with my ally, but I'm kind of like, I'm going to need to attack you. But before I can attack you, I'm going to have to like fight my way through these other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I started waging this massive war with the Cravers, which are this insectoid race who just, they just must consume. Like literally, they're a genetically modified organism that just like eats shit. Like that's what they do. They were designed as a weapon. Like imagine the Krogan or the Rachni in Mass Effect. But what they do is just they consume stuff. It's like sentient army ants.
How is that mechanically represented in Endless Space 2?
They suck planets dry.
Oh,
and the
cool.
longer they inhabit a planet, the more its core productive like values.
Oh, that's
plummet.
Really cool. Because like it's the opposite of what most other factions would be doing on a planet, right? Like you get to a planet, it's pretty shitty. You start to build it up because you're building factories and farms and you're building labs and all that. And by mid or late game, you've turned these planets into something that are like their output values are maximized or really efficient. And these guys just show up and like eat the planet,
pretty much. And like they don't eat it down to the bone.
Okay,
but. It's basically like its core values are all very, very low.
Right.
And whatever bonuses, like the building bonuses are still there, but what those bonuses are multiplying is much, much lower.
Gotcha.
And so it's, like they need to keep expanding because the longer they're in a system, the more, strip mined it gets and the less productive, the more marginal it becomes. So I start invading these guys, and we're fighting. It's a whole Donnybrook. Like they've got more advanced military technology. They can field bigger fleets, but I have just a limitless industrial capacity. Like I was literally just like spamming fleets at them. Like I would lose like 12 top of the line warships in a single turn, and 20 would hit the front line the next turn. Like it was just. It was brutal. It was like East Front 1945. Like, I don't even care about the losses. You're going down. It was cool.
Insect warfare.
Yes.
Almost.
and so I didn't, like, I had just finished like closing these guys out and was poised to attack my ally when they won the game. So I started a new game, and this is the thing that is really kind of weird about Endless Space 2. It feels like a totally different game. I started playing this other faction, I forget their names, but they're like fish people. And okay, their
Zora.
Opening,
okay,
their opening cutscene is like Goodfellas or The Godfather.
Yes, yes, it's so good. It's so good. So I still haven't put much time into this because I can't decide on a faction to learn. But I watched all of the intros and that
Austin, tell
intro,
us about this intro.
So it's this amazing. Here's the setup. The setup is like the three leaders of the space mob. Like they're aliens. They're like Star Trek aliens, right? They're like green reptile skin or something. I actually forget. I think that they have like weird antennae, maybe even.
No, they're like they've got like catfish whiskers.
They do have catfish. That's what it is. Yeah, they have catfish whiskers. Yeah. Yes. And they're like, oh, this kid, he's no good, I gotta tell you. And, like, they're kind of having this, like, rolling conversation slash debate about, like, I heard he went on to Talos 7 and took over all the drug labs, and he's, like, cut down to space alien, Ray Liotta kicking in the door, and then, like, talking
to dinner jacket.
Yes, in a dinner jacket. Yes, exactly. Like, oh, but I hear he has all the friends in all highest society, and then it's like him in a party or whatever. It's so good. It's like,
that's amazing.
I know I'm missing stuff because it's been like 2 weeks since I watched it. Rob, is there another highlight?
So there's also like you got members of the family being like, look, we're in the dust business,
right?
But no personal use.
No
we
personal
sell
use.
It, but we don't
use your
it.
Own supply.
And it cuts to this dude just like getting jacked up on the dust. Like his eyes are like glowing with magical dust.
It's very good. It's very good.
And that doesn't stop. That's the thing, is like you start the game. First of all, most of the soundtrack is shared, but it seems like each faction has like faction specific music.
Oh, and really?
And so this
for the
faction,
whole game?
I think. Because the first thing you hear with this faction is kind of this, like, jazzy mob movie, like horn solo kind of thing that's going on. And then your early quests are like, which of the families should we strike an alliance with?
Right, that's
well,
really good.
Well, these guys are good with the unions, but these guys are good with the drug trade. And so it's so weird. Like, I'm playing the same game, but everything about it just feels a little bit tweaked and a little more illicit,
right?
But
you're still
easier.
Like you're still like colonizing planets and putting down laser farms or whatever. But also, there's the instead of the political the voting system that you talked about with the whatever Space United Nations was called. This one has like inner familia like tension and stuff.
Well, so it looks like it draws the line at the politics. The political factions are still there. It looks like that's largely going to be the same from faction to faction. I think different races interact with that mechanic differently. But in the quest lines, you've got which family mafia bonuses do you want to get? Which ones do you want to do quests for? But then there are like major changes that come with this faction. Like, for instance, they don't build colony ships. They just buy planets.
Good.
And wow.
So,
that's easy.
There you go.
So you go out there, and like if you see a system, you just buy it. You just like click the button, and immediately a colony starts forming. Yes.
Wow.
But the price goes up with each colony, but it doesn't scale as fast as your economy is going to scale. So like you get off to maybe a slowish start. But then, like, you can just kind of go nuts on buying colonies. And I got in this, like, expansion race with the Horatio. Okay, we can talk about Horatio.
We have to talk about Horatio real quick. Yeah. All right, I want you... Okay, there's... Danielle, I want you to guess what the Horatio are, based on the name, the Horatio.
Okay. Are they... I don't know. I'm in, like, a Zelda mood right now. Are they, like, Rito-like... birdie people?
That's a good guess.
Very proud.
You know, bird aliens are totally a thing. No, the Horatio they're Horatio.
Are we going Shakespearean Horatio here? Is that
I think
what we're thinking?
They're very cultured.
They are.
Yeah?
Some would say they're the most cultured. Horatio would say that, certainly. Horatio is a really rich guy who other people didn't like, and he didn't like them, and so he was like, fuck it, man, I'll clone myself. And I'll make a whole culture of me.
So it's a technocrat.
It's one technocrat who then cloned himself a billion times.
So it's a whole race of himself who he thinks is the best person in the world.
And his name is Horatio.
And they share a collective identity. Like, they are not... It is not they're all clones made from a common, like, genetic stock. They are all Horatio.
Right.
They are all the best people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like... Why would they want to have sex with anyone who isn't Horatio? So, like, so their romantic partners are all Horatio. What do you want to do? Well, whatever Horatio feels like.
Whatever we want to. Yeah. And then
this is like Greek myth. Oh, kind
level. Yeah. Absolutely.
Holy shit.
Because then, like, their whole thing is also that when they go to other cultures, they can assimilate. Like whatever the genetic traits are of enemy species into Horatio's central bloodline. So it's a whole thing.
Wow.
Anyway, you were saying something about Horatio's, and we got distracted, Rob.
Yeah. So they're my nearest neighbor, and they're also colonizing really fast. And so I decided to nip that in the bud, and I saved up. And I just bought every single habitable system, like, in a ring around them.
Nice.
Including stuff I can't possibly defend if it comes to it, but just to, like, box them in.
Fuck it, you own it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it was this weird... It was this weird, like, you know, claim-jumping race in which, because I don't play by the rules that other races do, I was able to basically go from, like... A small, like, basically, I just had my home system. I hadn't projected out at all into the galaxy, to having like 12 star systems under my control in the space of like, you know, probably like 20 turns. And that blew up in my face a little bit because I didn't have enough food to go around. There's a little bit of a famine, but it all came out in the end. It's all good. And so now the Horatio are pissed at me, but I'm not sure I care.
No, fuck them. Fuck Horatio. You heard it here first.
Yeah. Seriously.
I am still working out how this game really does work and how it...
Sure.
Like, because there is so much stuff hidden in that tech tree. And this is what I wrote a little bit about this on the site this week. If you've played a lot of Civ, and at this point most everyone has encountered Civ at least once in their gaming career... you do have a sense for how that game flows and where it's headed and what stuff means. In Endless Space 2, there are so many interactions between like planet types and population types and then wonders and technology. And there's a lot of, like, you're not going to get most of the technologies in this game. You actually need to skip a lot of them, so you need to choose what's going to be complementary.
So, like, most games like this, you end up kind of like, I'm just going to have everything by the end, so whatever. And in this, there are actual choices about, like, not going down certain routes?
Yeah, because you just don't have the time. Like, even the really, like, basic technologies that would only take a couple turns to research later in the game, you just can't afford the opportunity cost of going back and getting that, unless you really need that resource. It might actually just be cheaper to buy that resource on the market. And don't learn to mine it yourself. But the thing is, then there's all these interactions that are going to take a lot of time for you to learn. And that's kind of where I'm still struggling, is that because, like, each of these, there are faction-specific technologies, a lot of them, because there are all these, like, unique interactions between, like, faction and climate and all this stuff, it makes it really tough to, like, get a sense of not only what you should be doing in a given moment, but what you're going to want to be doing later. And because that's really what 4X games are all about, is like setting yourself up for those late game pushes. And that's where I'm struggling to sort of see the road ahead of me.
I have a question. What is the combat like in this game? Like, because Endless Space 1, you just kind of said, like, okay, I'm going to put my ships in this formation and, like, maybe play, like, a special tactics card or something.
Yeah, it's still that. It sucks. Like,
that's a shame, because Endless Legend had, like, a pretty fun tactical combat mode when you went to war, and that's a shame.
Yeah, what Amplitude do with combat is they don't... give you direct control over, like, in none of their games do they give you direct control over anything. Like, in Endless Legend, and this is where things got cool.
Oh, you're totally right.
Yeah, in Endless Legend, you sort of gave an outline of your orders.
Yeah, you said, like, I want you to attack this enemy, but you didn't move the unit and then attack the enemy. And sometimes
you would maneuver to attack.
Right. You would be surprised because I think it was an all-at-once thing, right? Like, everybody kind of did their move. I might be misremembering, but I remember being surprised by outcomes often.
Well, because I think it was they would go and then you would go, and it went through a turn order, but you didn't control it. And so, like, if you assigned a target and that target moved out of range, your unit, depending on its orders, would either stand in position or it would just pursue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you didn't want it to make the decision that you'd outlined at the start. And so a lot of it became anticipating what that turn would look like, which was kind of a cool thing. A lot cooler than this. I would say, like, the combat in Endless Space 2, it looks cool.
Okay.
But you're going to auto-resolve most of your combat because there's just not much. Nothing happens in the combat. This is the other thing that kind of sucks about it, is that in Endless Legend, between turns, you'd have the option of assigning new orders.
Uh-huh.
There are no turns in this. It's just a battle plays out according to phases.
And you just fast forward through it if you want to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's definitely the weakest part of this, because I'm sure there's a way to play your cards right and use the correct tactics cards. Uh-huh. Like, there are ways to take advantage of that, but it feels pretty marginal, and it's not super rewarding, which is a shame given how, like, cool a lot of the spaceships look and how awesome a lot of technology you put on them is.
That is a shame. Well, I'm still going to try to spend some time with it at some point. Probably not this weekend, maybe next weekend. We'll see.
Can one of you guys stream it so I can watch it?
That's a good idea.
I really want to see this in action, you know?
Yeah, we should try to figure that out maybe next week at some point.
All right. I like it.
We should go to the question bucket. If you have a question for us, you can email it to gamingadvice.com and use the subject question bucket, and we'll toss it into the question bucket. It's a Friday, which means we're going digging deep. I'm going to need a number from one of you.
38.
Rob, yes.
Rob's number game is really good. Rob just, like, has a number in his head, and
he
boom,
knows.
38. Okay, this comes in from Brandon from Ohio, who says, hello to you all. My question is for Mr. Austin Walker. It is about The Witcher 3 and the Giant Bomb Game of the Year Awards 2015.
Oh, Brandon!
While listening to the Giant Bomb Game of the Awards 2015 edition, I couldn't help notice how you seemed how down you seemed in The Witcher 3. It barely made it in the overall top 10 list that year. Listen to your thoughts on the game now. It seems your opinions have changed. I was curious if you could go back and change your top 10 list of games from 2015. Would The Witcher 3 be on it? Probably not. I'm still really think
Austin?
The Witcher 3 is really good. But it just didn't... I haven't gone back and beaten it, right? Like, I committed to myself this beginning of the year to go back and play through that game and then bounce off of it again. I got a little bit further and bounced off of it again. And every couple of months, I dip back in and bounce off of it again.
In The Witcher 3's defense, it's 2017.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. True.
Like, every other month has had a game of all time contender.
Right.
Well, okay.
Exactly.
Maybe I'm exaggerating slightly, but this year has been abnormal.
I'm going to look at my Giant Bomb 2015 list just to see if I would
So I think there's crucial context here, though.
Yeah.
Which is that Austin was using some really aggressive game theory tactics throughout that entire debate. Like, what Austin really thought of the games of 2015 is not what Austin was doing in those debates and in those podcasts.
No. But my personal list is what this person is talking about.
Okay.
Witcher
3 is not
on.
My personal list for 2013 or 2015 was Her Story, Cybele, Dragon Ball Xenoverse, Elite Dangerous, Grow Home, Wheels of Aurelia, Fallout 4, Galaxy the Dimensional, Undertale, and Invisible Inc. I appreciate that Austin Walker of 2015 included the notes I used to argue for Invisible Inc. in this this write-up of my top 10 games. And, like, this is what it comes down to is any sort of personal list, any sort of personal evaluation needs to be, like, radically honest about the amount of joy that you take from something. And I am not here to do the, like, I've never been here to do the, like, score tallying style of criticism that is, hey, is this thing good in the culture or in the history of games? Because if so, then, like, yeah, I bet you The Witcher 3 would make it onto my list. But it doesn't make sense to include it on my list, because that's not what I did in 2015. It's not what I've done since that's made me happy, like, deeply happy in the way that it makes other people. I'm glad it makes other people deeply happy. But, like, it just didn't for me. And so I have to be honest to that, separate from whatever the wider response is, you know? That's my answer. I'm sticking to it.
All right. I'm reading this list, Austin, and I really respect the hell out of it besides the inclusion of Fallout 4 at number 4.
But that, again, like, this is the thing. That. Is like, okay, so for Fallout 4, like, I fucking moved from Canada to home for the first time. You know, I spent 5 years in Canada. I moved home and then got to play a game in which it was set in a kind of a weird Boston, and I got to make a home, right? Like, I spent so much time in Fallout 4 building settlements, and I loved that because it's something I'd wanted in Bethesda games for years, and when they added the Skyrim, it didn't really work for me. And then it worked for me in Fallout 4, and I understand why it didn't work for a lot of people, but, like, it really did. I spent way more time building a basketball court in Fallout 4 and building bars and building outposts and building gardens and huge farms than I did, like, enjoying my time with Geralt. Like, and that's not...
I get it.
A subjective experience.
For my backstory on that, I tried real hard to get Witcher 3 on the top 10 of Polygon's list. And it lost because
also
of one person voting for Fallout 4 over it, and I'm just mad, and it's okay. I'm just, you know, sometimes we have to process our grief.
I bet you that list didn't have half of the weird games on my list on it, so I'm.
It sure didn't.
Polygon 2015 Game of the Year.
This is gonna make me angry. It's gonna make
Why?
It's gonna make you so mad, Rob.
Why?
You don't even know.
None of this matters.
Okay, Rocket League is. Yeah, good.
Rocket League's a great
good
game.
Paul.
I know Bloodborne was on there.
Foam was a good
Mario
game.
Mario Maker was on there.
Okay. Splatoon's a great game.
I'm just going from memory because I made every one of those videos from those.
Life is Strange is a great game.
Yes, Life is Strange made it.
Taken
there
King.
Were some good games on there.
Good.
Taken King is a great game. Fallout 4 is a game that I like more than most people.
It's fine.
Super Mario Maker is a great game.
Yes, it is.
Phantom Pain is a great game. I think it's way too long, but I really love my time with Phantom Pain.
I think only like two of my
the one you cut here is
on
Fallout
list.
4, for sure. Like, I definitely think that's the case.
Phantom Pain.
Phantom Pain. I
think my concern, I don't know. Like, I think the weird thing with a game like Phantom Pain is that it comes out so late in the year that I literally never had time to play it. Before, you know what I mean? Okay. It, like, came out, like, in December.
Did it? No, it didn't.
I think it came out really late.
It came out late. It definitely
came
out
pretty late. No, it super didn't. You're both wrong.
What?
It came out in September.
Was it October? Oh, my God.
September 1st. So, no. There was plenty of time to play Phantom.
No, there wasn't.
Absolutely right.
So.
September. That's right in the middle of release season. How can I find time to play the new release in September when there's so many releases, Austin?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a tough year, and The Witcher 3, I mean, like, for what it's worth, I think part of the problem for a lot of, part of the reason that The Witcher 3 didn't win huge awards in a lot of places is it was a super long game, and game reviewers can't play super long games if they're not assigned those reviews. It's
true.
Really hard to find the time to do that. And that was part of it for me, right? Like, if I'd been still in grad school, I probably would have played through The Witcher 3 all the way through, partially because I would have bought it and it would have been the only game I could have afforded for 4 months, and partially because, like, I had a little more free time and would just, like, stay up late and just pour hours into it. And my grad school work would have suffered for it, but I would have fucking done it anyway. As a actual games journalist, like, it's hard to devote that much time to one thing if you can't be writing about it, you know? So I don't know.
Sorry, my top three, in case you're wondering, because I know you definitely were Dropsy, Soma, and Witcher 3.
That's a good list.
You know?
It was a good games. It was a good year for games that year.
It was.
You should play Undertale, Danielle.
I played some of it.
You should play through all of it.
I think the problem was I played a bunch of it, and then the massive Undertale Appreciation Society happened, and I think the hype, it was one of those cases where the hype maybe got a little bit in the way of
you should
of
yeah. I think you should go back to it now knowing that it's, like, a thing you'll enjoy, and, like, that's going to be, that's the height of it. Like, that's the height of my recommendation for that game. Has always been, like, I think this game's really funny and good and has a lot of heart and is really cool, but also, like, I think you'll have a good time. And, like, that's kind of it. Like, I don't think it's going to change your life. I don't think it's going to maybe move you the way it moved some other people. But, like, if you ever find yourself with, like, 10 extra hours or something to play through it a couple of times and get a couple of the endings, it is super worth doing that. Because I went in hyper-skeptical and came out a believer, so.
I see. All right, I'll give it a shot. I will.
Okay. I think that's going to do it for us. I don't have it in me to do another question because I'm, as you can tell, I'm sick and completely. But my life is blurry right now. Everything around me is strange, and I'm exhausted. So I'm going to head out. You can find me on the internet. I'm dying.
Oh no!
You can find me on the internet.
You can find him in the obituary section.
Yeah, in the obituary, exactly. God. Here lived Austin Walker. Here lived Austin underscore Walker on Twitter. You can find everything we do at waypoint.vice.com, facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. Danielle, where can people find you?
I'm at Danielle RI on Twitter.
And Rob Zachney.
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
All right, shout-outs to Tim Barnes for producing. You can find Tim at TimBarnes451 on Twitter. And you can find info about Bowen, who's letting us use his song Miss You off of the EP Pale Machine at waypoint.zone/BOEN. That's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back on Monday with like a special question bucket episode for Memorial Day. That'll probably be a little shorty, but you know.
Fuck it, we're going to the bucket.
Going to the bucket.
Did you like that?
Catch us then. That's going to do it for us this week. Danielle, what do we say?
Be good or be good at it.
Peace.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.